see you, Mike.
Good evening and welcome to the March 19th, 2018 Astoria City Council meeting. Welcome to all of you who are here. Roll call, Chief Ames.
Councilor Neville.
Here.
Councilor Press.
Here.
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 Here. Thank you. The first item of business is a proclamation. Is there anyone here from the harbor at this time? Okay. Well, I'll read the proclamation, and then when they get here, we'll present it. Whereas sexual assault affects Oregonians every day, whether as a victim or a survivor, or as a family friend, member, partner, neighbor, employer, or coworker of a survivor, and whereas Oregonians of all gender identities experience sexual violence, including an estimated 1 in 4 adult women who has been the victim of rape, and nearly 1 in 5 men who has experienced sexual violence in their lifetime. And whereas certain populations in Oregon experience much higher rates of sexual violence due to systemic oppression and inequality. And whereas compassionate, courageous, and dedicated individuals, local organizations, and other partners have provided services and support for victims and survivors and worked to prevent sexual violence for decades. And whereas sexual violence is preventable and all communities are strengthened by encouraging healthy, nonviolent interactions, relationships, and social norms. And whereas every individual and community in Oregon has a role to play to help eliminate sexual violence by working together to promote social change. Now, therefore, I, Arlene Lemire, Mayor of Astoria, do hereby proclaim April as Sexual Assault Awareness Month in the City of Astoria and encourage all citizens to join in this observance. Next on the agenda is reports of councilors. Councilor Nimmowell.
Yes, thank you, Mayor. I wanted to bring up the issue of school safety in light of the recent tragic shootings in Florida. It's something, as a parent of school-aged children, that I see the schools are preparing with drills, and now you can't enter the elementary schools without the office buzzing you in. So those are definitely good steps on the part of the school district. And also, it was reassuring to hear from our police chief recently the fact that school safety is a big priority for Astoria Police Department, and there are efforts being made locally and on the part of the police chief at the state level as well. And just wanted to draw some attention to that, and if it's okay with you, Mayor, and Mr. City Manager, see if there's anything the police chief would like to add or elaborate on.
Okay, thank you.
Well, thank you, Councilor. Mayor, Councilor Jeff Spaulding, your police chief. Councilor Demler, you're right. School safety is one of our highest priorities, as it is, I know it is, of yours as well. And we've taken a lot of effort, especially in light of the recent tragedy in Parkland, Florida. And that's there's been obviously a national conversation on this regarding tactics, how individuals responded. And we always learn from these tragedies. Unfortunately, it takes these events to raise the public awareness of these issues. And it's no different for law enforcement as well, because we constantly have these conversations. But just to let council know, when we talk about this being one of our highest priorities, what we're actually doing about this. So part of it is having internal conversations and making sure that the individuals in our own organization, that we all are on the same page in terms of our response, and make sure that we are, that the officers of the department are clear of my expectations. And I'm sorry, you want me to stand by just for a second here?
Yeah,
do
you
want to
come on in and sit down, and then we'll continue.
Okay, so just continuing, just again, it's make sure that the individual officers in our department are well aware of my expectations and that we constantly are reviewing our tactics. And as a result of the recent tragedy in Florida, we've already looked at several of our tactics. We've actually made some modifications to the way we respond to school shootings or any active shooter incident for as well, in addition to looking at being more proactive in some of these incidents. So in addition to that, you know, I reached out to our county sheriff along with some of the other law enforcement leaders in our county, and we had a meeting last week and discussed mutual aid response so that we're all responding on the same page, that our policies and protocols are all consistent, since it's entirely likely that in a major event that we're all going to be responding to the same school from, it doesn't matter what jurisdiction we work in. So that's critical. So we had a really good meeting, we had a good discussion, and some of the things that came out of that meeting include making sure that the schools are participating in the training that we do on these, so they're up to speed as well. And then more recently, towards the end of last week, I met with the school superintendent, my deputy chief and I, Eric, met with the school superintendent, some of his principals, and some of his key staff, and went over a whole laundry list of topics to include topics such as the school lockdowns, the protocol they're using right now, which is the standard response protocol, which is used by most of the schools in our county. And other topics that we discussed were the state tip line, student threat assessment protocol, and some of our tactics. Obviously, I'm not going to go into tactics tonight for obvious reasons, but I'm really happy to report that the school district is very proactive and they're already ahead of the game. And one of the things I'll talk about here in just a second is the tip line, and I can say that all the schools in our district are part of the statewide tip line. So it was a good meeting. They're very interested in school safety, as you might imagine, and they're also very much on board when it comes to training with us. So that's something we look forward to as well. You mentioned also my involvement with the Governor's Task Force on School Safety, and clearly this has been a priority for this group. Our group originally was the main focus was on mapping systems and, you know, how do we respond better to schools, but the task force quickly realized that it was more important that we had a proactive response to the school shootings. So one of the things that came out of that discussion was a statewide tip line, which is now in effect and is managed by the Oregon State Patrol. And there's now 910 schools throughout the state, and in the last two quarters been over 500 tips, and they've had several actual success stories as a result of the tip line. And some of the out of those 500 calls, priority wise in terms of the types of calls that they're getting to the tip line, as you might imagine, are bullying. They're also getting threats to school safety, they're getting suicidal threats, sexual assault type things like the sexting and those types of things. And so that's been a very successful product that's come out of the task force. And then the other thing, of course, is the student threat assessment. And we're working with the school district now to more formalize a student threat assessment model for the school, which is a multidisciplinary approach where you have individuals from the mental health system, the police, and other entities get together and you kind of critique or look at potential threats for the school and try to avert things before they become more significant events. So again, we're taking a look at it from multiple angles and all approaches and make sure that everybody's on the same page in responding to these type of things with the main focus of preventing them before they happen. So just want to give you a little update.
Okay, I thank you very much for making this a priority.
You're welcome.
Okay, is this to do with this particular
thing? Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. David Ozer, 254 West Irving, and I'm speaking as a member of the school board. So I just wanted to reassure the council that the school board is very, very aware of safety issues. It's one of our highest priorities, and not only in what we're doing currently with the interim safety measures and bringing another full-time mental health counselor into the schools, but as we look forward to the improvements that we will be but I expect that we'll be putting on the ballot in November. Many of them are long-term safety measures for the schools and the campuses that just weren't thought of when they were designed. So it is a very, very high priority issue for us.
Thank you. Okay, Councilor Brownson.
Hi, I just wanted to mention that I was over at the Harbor's Open House just before I came here, and was really impressed with the offices that you have and the facility you have now. I hope it really helps you move forward in doing, you know, the really important work that you're doing. And the only other thing I wanted to mention was that, just to remind people, that we had a work session where we talked about enterprise zones, and quite specifically because we have HIAC Limited coming in to put in boat repair, to enhance boat repair facilities, as well as leading towards manufacturing of tugboats and barges. And he outlined what will be a premier marine facility on the West Coast. And I just wanted to make sure people heard that, because it's really important for Astoria. It's bringing, it'll bring a lot of living wage jobs, family wage jobs into the town, as well as just strengthening our general economy. So I'm really happy to support their endeavors out there, and the development of Tongue Point is something that's going to be a real asset to the community. That's it.
Thank you.
Councilor Price.
Thank you, and good evening. Thanks to the dedicated few who came to my Salonical a week or so ago. It's always great to talk to the public in a group. Everybody gets a, sort of a, to talk on each other and communicate with each other. That's nice. I attended, as did the mayor, the CASA annual banquet Friday night, I think it was, or sometime last week. And the young woman who spoke for CASA, she did not have a CASA when she was a kid. CASA is court-appointed special advocates. She didn't have a CASA when she was a kid, but she sure could use one, have used one in the family that she was growing up in. And she said something really stuck with me, which is, we don't need anyone to save us, we just need someone to believe in us. And I thought that that was just a really wonderful sentiment for them, and probably some of the women at the harbor feel the same way, although of course sometimes they need saving, for sure. And also I have spent a lot of time the last week or two with the Astoria Ferry, the tourist number two, on which I'm delighted to be a board member, and I'm really, really thrilled to see it in downtown Astoria. And I just want to give my great thanks to city staff for allowing the ferry to be there for an extended period of time. It is an Astoria icon built here in 1924, and I hope that we can make it successful. And again, I just thank you very much.
Councilor Jones.
Good evening, Mayor. I'll pass tonight. Thanks.
Okay, and I will too. We have a very full agenda. Molly, would you like to come up and get the proclamation? We did read it already, but we'll come on up and we'll present it. And you might introduce yourself to the group.
Hi there. My name's Molly Pringle. I'm the new executive director at the Harbor. We're Astoria's and Clatsop County's primary community-based nonprofit supporting survivors of domestic and sexual violence.
Okay, there you go.
Thank you. Can I say one more quick thing?
Sure.
I just wanted to say that I don't know if you got to the column lighting element of this
yet.
Okay, but we're proposing that we light the column teal to recognize Sexual Assault Awareness Month. And I just wanted to say that when you all see the column lit teal, think about how you all can play a role in ending sexual violence in our community, and that we all have a part to play in that. So just wanted to call that to your mind.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And if it's okay with the rest of the council, I would like to move the other items in front of the, it just changes to an agenda. The regular agenda items, will make the public hearing at the end so we can get through the other items, which should go quickly, and then we can spend the majority of the evening on that appeal. Any?
Sounds good.
Problems? Okay.
Good.
Okay. The next item on our agenda is the consent calendar, and the items on the consent calendar are passed with one motion unless someone has asked for an item to be removed. Has anyone from the community asked for an item to
no.
be removed?
No citizen requests.
Okay, how about the council? Could we have a motion to approve the consent calendar?
I move we approve the consent calendar.
Second.
Roll call, Chief Spaulding.
Councilor Dembowell?
Aye.
Councilor Brownson?
Aye.
Councilor Price?
Aye.
Councilor Jones?
Aye.
Mayor
Lemire? Aye. Thank you. Okay, our first regular agenda item then will be 7B, second reading and ordinance amendment.
So on March 5th, the council conducted the first reading of an ordinance amending the zoning map and also some text amendments to the development code, which would facilitate the expansion of the Escherich Co-op, and this followed a public hearing on the matter, which was closed on March 5th. I would note that the acreage of the zone map amendment on the private parcel owned by Mr. Ballister is 1.04 acres, and that was the amount that was included on the application for this zone change. This is the area proposed for development by the co-op, and it has not changed since the initial application. However, because we need a legal description to allow city staff to map the area on the official city zoning map, a meets and bounds description is required. And it is now listed as 1.45 acres because it encompasses portions of the rights-of-way of 23rd Street, Steam Whistle Way, and Marine Drive, which have zoning as well. So I just want to note that the development area is the same, but the acreage in total is more because of those rights-of-way. Tonight, it's recommended that council hold the second reading and consider adopting the ordinance.
Okay. Ms. Brooks, could we have the second reading, please?
An ordinance amending the Astoria land use and zoning map by rezoning of parcel at 2350 Marine Drive from AH-MP Affordable Housing Milpon to LS Local Service.
And Mayor and Councilors, I would note that in before you, to make sure we follow the appropriate protocol for motions for a land use item, there is a suggested form of a motion if you're seeing fit to adopt the ordinance.
Well, I move that the Astoria City Council adopt the findings and conclusions contained in the staff report and adopt the ordinance amending the zoning map and text of the development code to facilitate the expansion of the Astoria Co-op Grocery.
And I will recuse myself from the vote because I'm an employee of Astoria Co-op Grocery. I'm the marketing director, so I will recuse myself from the vote.
I second the motion.
Any discussion by the council? Okay, we'll have a roll call. Mr. Harrington.
Councilor Nimmelow?
She's recused.
Oh, sorry. Councilor
Nimmelow? Aye.
Councilor Price?
Aye.
Councilor Jones?
Aye.
Mayor Lemire?
Aye. Thank you. Okay, the next item is a supplemental budget public hearing.
So the Oregon Revised Statutes provides guidance for a municipality to hold a public hearing when a supplemental budget is needed to adjust for changes which could come up after preparing the original budget. So there are several funds which are being proposed for amendment tonight. The first one is the Parks Operations Fund. Staff had developed adjustments for the current fiscal year budget based upon direction provided from extensive workshops to develop a modified parks scenario, which included implementation of additional 2% transit room tax. And this was used to be able to provide for what was called a life raft scenario identified by our parks director to maintain tourist facilities and to stabilize the parks and recreation workforce on eligible Promote Astoria projects and functions. So in the parks operations funds, there is a transfer from the Promote Astoria fund to the parks operations fund in the amount of $116,700 for the current fiscal year. And that represents the anticipated revenues from the enacted increase to be collected this fiscal year, along with a $216,000 transfer from the general fund. In the general fund, the beginning fund balance was estimated and budgeted to be $2,227,600 for the current fiscal year. However, the actual beginning fund balance was approximately $500,000 more than originally estimated due to one-time occurrences and wage savings and more revenue realized over budget projections from transient room tax, property tax, and also franchise fees. A transfer from the general fund to the partial operation fund in the amount of $216,000 is included, as I identified, would be received in the parks operations fund. Additionally, this is a proposal which is being made by myself for the general fund for a transfer from the general fund to the public works improvement fund. And this would be used to sunset the landfill closure loan, which we are presently paying on to pay off the debt, which was necessitated to close the landfill up at the top of the hill. It's desirable to retire this this debt in the landfill closure loan with these available funds in the general fund. And this will allow for funds which are coming from tipping fees from the ecology contract to go directly to the general fund for next fiscal year to provide additional resources towards the general fund. Now, there is approximately a balance of $261,000, and it's estimated that there's about a little over $4,000 in interest, and an estimated payoff is approximately $265,000. I would note that over the remaining life alone, we would save approximately $10,000 in interest. So there's, I'd say, two wins, saving the interest, but also being able to free up some funds to be able to put in our general fund for this next fiscal year. Then in the Public Works Improvement Fund, there's the commensurate transfer to pay off the debt, as I mentioned, for the landfill closure loan. And then lastly, in the Promote Astoria Fund, there's the transfer of the $116,700, as I mentioned, towards the parks fund. So it's very circular, as you'll see within the various funds. A public hearing is required to be held tonight, so Mayor, it's recommended that the City Council conduct a public hearing and approve the supplemental budgets as presented in the resolution.
Okay, Council, do you want to say anything, or shall I go ahead and open the public hearing? Okay, open the public hearing on the supplemental budget. Anyone want to come and speak to that? Okay, I will close the public hearing. Anyone want to make a motion?
Yes, I'll make a motion. And first, I would like to thank Finance Director Susan Brooks for sending along this afternoon the quarterly budget summaries that bring us up to date through this fiscal year. I appreciate that very much because I would have difficulty voting on this without that. It really is not at all a matter of trust. I hope everyone knows that. It is. I just think that it is something that we really are required to have for proper oversight of the budget. So I had that. I had a chance to look at it. And in that case, I will find the wording. Thank you. That we approve the supplemental budget as presented in the attached resolution.
Second.
Okay, we need a roll call vote. Ms. Cosby?
Councilor Nemelo?
Aye.
Councilor Brownson?
Aye.
Councilor Price?
Aye.
Councilor Jones?
Aye.
Mayor Lemire?
Aye. Thank you. Okay, the next item is the council policy on column lighting.
In 2014, the council gave direction to the Parks Department to limit the use of colored lighting effects on the column to twice a year when specifically authorized by City Council. In 2017 and 18, additional column lighting requests had been received. It's been the process when requests are received, they go through the Parks Department staff. Due to the council direction provided in 2014 to limit the use of colored lighting effects twice a year, Any additional requests received within a fiscal year have not been processed at the staff level. It's been requested that this policy be brought back to council for further discussion. In the memo, it's noted that the Friends of the Astoria Column were holding a meeting this last Friday to discuss this topic. I'm going to ask our Parks Director, Angela Cosby, to provide an update as to what the Friends of the Column had stated with regards to this policy.
Thank you. Yes, Friday evening, the Friends of the Column held a special meeting largely to discuss this topic to be able to provide a recommendation. After a lengthy discussion, the Friends of the Column ultimately decided on, seeing that the Friends are responsible for the care and maintenance of the column, the surrounding park site, the facility, and the programmatic decisions that can heavily impact them. So the Friends have requested that City Council allow the Friends to manage all lighting effects into the future. To accomplish this and to work proactively with the council, the Friends have proposed that they will create a fair and equitable policy on lighting effects that will be brought back to you, City Council, for approval. And that will take into consideration the importance of the historic landmark and local, state, and national events.
Okay.
So tonight it's recommended that council review their established policy and provide any feedback.
Madam Mayor, thank you for putting this on the agenda. This is something that I requested because I received a request from Cameron Tillman, who's here tonight and representing the Pride group, the Pride Festival, to light the column during Pride Week in July. So I had been thinking about this column lighting thing myself for a number of years, and sometimes I like it and sometimes I don't. The sort of the way I put it is, you know, is it our Mona Lisa or is it our Empire State Building? And if it's our Mona Lisa, then we shouldn't be putting colored lights on it. If it's our Empire State Building, let's use it more often and celebrate and commemorate all sorts of things without, you know, being really ridiculous about it. And then Cameron actually said, well, it's both. So then I don't know how you make that happen, which it probably is. So I figured that the Friends would really want to have some say in this. It makes sense to me. I would ask if the council wants to let the Friends have this time and to bring a policy back to us that meets their needs, that we ask them to do it sooner rather than later, because we do have some other requests that are coming, you know, of Pride in July. I also received just today a request from Jeff Daly, who has this very groovy thing going on called Illuminart that's going to be all throughout Astoria during April, second Saturday, the 14th. And, you know, if we're going to be more liberal with the use of it, that would certainly be a great time to really light up the column, do some effect. So I'll leave it at that.
Okay. Anyone else have anything they want to add?
Well, you know, I'll be interested to hear what the Friends of the Column think about this. You know, once touring the Parks Department shops, you know, I saw the huge lights, you know, that are used to light the column, and kind of realized that this was a big undertaking for the parks crew. And in terms of prioritizing parks, you know, efforts right now, lighting the column doesn't really seem like, you know, something that should be a priority. So if the Friends of the Column are interested in taking it on, you know, I'd be interested to hear what they have to say. You know, I think that the city can support worthwhile causes and events without lighting the column too. You know, we just leased the Pride group property for $1, you know. And in terms of sexual assault awareness, I kind of wonder if anyone knows, you know, or if the vast majority of people even know why the column would be lit teal during a certain month or pink during another month. You know, I question the necessity of it, and In terms of priorities, if it were on the Parks Department, doesn't really seem like it should be a priority. And I guess I haven't really heard from the public either way, from either proponents of lighting the column or not.
Okay, thank you. Anyone else?
Yeah, and I'll agree with Councilor Neville on that. I'm really interested to see what the Friends bring forward, and I would just caution that I think the idea of a Mona Lisa or Empire State Building and it being both just says that maybe it is an effective tool to bring awareness for things that we feel are really important. And publicity has a lot to do with why it's being lit up for a particular reason. So when people look up there, they think about it, such as what we're going to be addressing with the harbor and the teal thing. So, but then if we're lighting it up every other weekend, you know, it kind of loses its effect. It's sort of more of a, I don't know, carnival, as opposed to a serious awareness situation. So I'm interested in hearing more discussion on this.
Okay.
I'm in favor of them bringing us a proposal, and I would recommend that their proposal include some discussion of how they would recommend paying for it, other than having the park staff do it. It's going to be more than twice a year.
Okay. Thank you. Ms. Cosby, can I ask you, when they were talking about it, the Friends of the Column, are they talking about taking over the cost, or did they mention that?
They're looking at managing it. Most of the cost does come from staff time and adjusting the frames. They're looking at doing it all themselves. So,
thank you. Okay, thank you. We'll look forward to having the Friends come back then with a proposal.
Mm-hmm. Madam Mayor, if I could just add that the thing that interested me in this most was that this policy was set in 2014, and that since then, the same two angel groups really have had those months. And I just, whatever happens, if we do continue to allow lighting, I hope that we will have a policy and procedure in place that is transparent about when can you apply to do it, and the procedure for it, and should there be some sort of limit on the number of years that one group can have it, just so that the column isn't for only two groups in perpetuity.
Okay, thank you. Okay, item 7E, and this is the authorization to light the column teal for the month of April.
So in partnership with the Domestic Violence Council, the Harbor and the Parks Department, there's a request to change the lighting color on the column to teal for the month of April 2018 in recognition of Sexual Assault Awareness and Child Abuse Awareness Month. In recognition of the current in place established policy, this would be the second request for the 2017-2018 fiscal year. And Angela, if you would please also provide kind of a brief statement in terms of what the Friends of the Column had stated on this, and that it's standard for them to provide their input to the council on this matter.
Sure. This discussion came up right after the previous one. So the Friends of the Column did not choose to provide a recommendation one way or another on this. They realize a policy won't be pumped out in the next 2 weeks to be able to, for it to take effect by April. So they just remained neutral to let City Council make that decision.
So it's recommended that Council consider authorizing the change in lighting at the column to a teal hue for the month of April 2018.
Okay, and this is in not only for Sexual Assault Awareness Month, but also Child Abuse Awareness Month. It also, the request came from CASA as well. So, and my feeling on it is that I think if it isn't overused, that when you look up at the column and you see a color up there, you're going to ask why. And I think it does bring awareness to the reason for changing the color at the column, so I am in support of this.
Well, I'd like to make a motion to authorize the Light the Astoria Column Teal Hue for the month of April in recognition of Sexual Assault Awareness Month and Child Abuse Awareness Month.
Okay, is there a second?
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Thank you. Okay, and thank you to all of you from the harbor who have come. Could the harbor people stand up so we can see who you are? Thank you for the work that you did. Okay. The next item are our 2018 City Council goals.
So in February, the City Council held a goal-setting session to develop City Council goals for fiscal year 2018-19. There was one goal where language was not prepared, but the intent was stated, which was to work with the Library Foundation to have language that could be brought back for consideration for supporting their efforts to fundraise the money for the renovation of the Astor Library. I'd met with the chair of the foundation, and this language is what was proposed for City Council consideration. I would note that it's a typical practice of the City Council to have these brought to Council at two different sessions, where they're brought to be able to be see whether or not there's any wordsmithing which is requested, and then be able to have a period of time brought back at a subsequent meeting for ultimate adoption, if that's your direction you'd like to move forward with again this year.
Any disagreement with that? Should we bring it forward the next meeting? Okay.
I'm okay with it now. I think they pretty well capture the discussion, but tonight or next meeting, either way.
Anyone want to, I mean, do we want to go ahead and accept them this evening, or do you want to put it off?
Make a motion.
Okay.
Let me just look at you. Well, there's nothing written. So I move that we adopt the draft fiscal year 2018-2019 goals as written.
Second. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Good. Thank you. Okay, we have now gone through the agenda except for the public hearing. So we'll head for that one now. Item 7A.
On January 17, 2018, the Historic Landmarks Commission held a public hearing and reviewed a request to demolish a multifamily dwelling at 347 Alameda Avenue. And with a vote of 3-3, which constitutes a denial, the Landmarks Commission denied the request. In late January of 2018, the applicant submitted an appeal of the Landmarks Commission's decision of denying the demolition. I'd like to now turn the presentation over to our planner, Nancy Ferber, to provide more detail on the Landmarks Commission's decision before the public hearing is opened.
Thank you. Hi. It's not often that we get an appeal for a demolition request, so I wanted to run through a little bit about the criteria for that, the timeline for a general land use related decision, and then some next steps related specifically to this appeal. So again, this was an application by Ted and Wendy Osborne for a structure at 347 Alameda that's adjacent to their house up on Alameda in Uniontown. And the original proposal was a demolition of a 3.5-story primary contributing historic building in the Uniontown Historic District. But before we get into those details, the kind of overarching timeline for an appeal, we deemed this application complete back in January. It was denied by HLC in December. It was denied in January. The appeal was submitted at the end of January, and that brings us to the City Council hearing tonight. And then the overarching kind of land use timeline for this is the 120-day window, which is applicable to any land use decision that's an ORS, Oregon Land Use Rule, times out at April 10th. So it's a good date to keep in mind as we move forward with a decision. But to back up to the original proposal, this is the exact same information that the Historic Landmarks Commission received. So this isn't new information from staff. This is just what they reviewed, and this is all in your packet. There are slides in there as well. So the original request was for a complete demolition. That's 347 Alameda, that kind of large purple building to the right. It's a Queen Anne, a multifamily structure, and it was built circa 1908. Again, it's a primary contributing structure, so it's a pretty important structure in that Uniontown district. And it's adjacent to the Kingston Avenue public right-of-way, which is important later on. And again, it's in that Uniontown district, so it's not just a one-off landmark building. I included some pictures to get an idea of the, what's happened at that site. Back in 2004, there was a house in front of this building. It's the one kind of second down in the top left corner. Then in 2010, adjacent to the applicant's single-family dwelling, between 2010 and 2015, a single-family dwelling was demolished just adjacent to the 347 Alameda structure. That structure was not historic. That's where that gap is right now. So that house did not come under review by the Historic Landmarks Commission. But this one, the 347, that large structure that's remaining, is in fact contributing, which is why it was reviewed by HLC. But this kind of gives a little bit of a timeline of what's been happening at that site. Again, there's some more photos. I did a site visit back in December and January when this first went to Planning Commission. It's a pretty large building. It's pretty important in that streetscape along Alameda. And again, that Kingston Avenue right-of-way looks like it's part of the property, and it's actually public right-of-way right adjacent to it where the cars are parked. It's sort of a dead end, but it's a public street there. This is the nitty-gritty details of what was reviewed by HLC. So there's two pieces to this, the development code for historic properties, that's Article 6, and then also the comprehensive plan, which is applicable to any land use decision. So specifically for demolitions, 6.080 A and B provide kind of two paths for demolition requests. There's option kind of A is an immediate demolition, which is applicable if the building official has deemed a structure an immediate threat to public health and safety. That means it has to come down right away. It's too dangerous to be up at and a building. Or if the structure has been damaged in excess of 70% of the assessed value due to fire, flood, wind, or natural disaster or vandalism. With those two key pieces, that allows staff to either do an immediate approval or bump it to HLC for review, which is what happened in this case. And then, as an added level for this, because the applicant appealed on this specific criteria, there's also an article in Article 9 that allows any permit that's reviewed by staff to be allowed to be bumped up by the Community Development Director to be reviewed by either Planning Commission or Historic Landmarks Commission. So if there's a question, it takes the burden off of staff and is allowed to be reviewed by a bigger, larger body, which also was applicable in this case. Also related to that, so that's sort of the review side, part two is 6.080C, and that's the economic feasibility related to this site. So that was information provided by the applicant of how feasible it is to rehabilitate the site. If proposed, what new use will go in at that site, and then the documented need for a new use if proposed, which there wasn't one in this application. This was just a demolition without any new construction proposed. The right side of this is the comprehensive plan, which I pulled out sections that are applicable to demolition, specifically for historic preservation, which is outlined in the comprehensive plan pretty extensively for policies around preservation, and then also related to economic development, tourism in our historic districts, alternatives to relocation instead of demolition, and housing was also in that original section. So that's the original criteria that HLC looked at for review. They also looked at, before it got to HLC, I worked extensively with the applicant for options at the site. So this was reviewed in the packet and was also discussed at HLC. So there was a conversation about potentially saving and restoring the structure at the site, or moving the structure out of where it currently is and into that right-of-way, which would have required a property use acquisition, which eventually would have been reviewed by City Council, and I'm happy to answer questions on that. It's a bit of an unusual circumstance, but ultimately the applicant decided not to request to move the building or change the building, but just to demolish it completely. So that was sort of number five once we whittled through all of these options at the site. HLC ultimately denied this demolition request and adopted the findings of facts in that original application with these four kind of recommendations that were related to it. And they specifically noted that the applicant should exhaust all options to save that structure through relocation and or sale of the building. The applicant may submit an exterior alteration request to shrink the size of the building to lower the rehabilitation costs, which relates to that feasibility of how much it would cost to rehab the site. They also looked at the analysis of potential uses that could generate more income at the building. The applicant just noted rehabbing the site and using it for a rental, but it could be sold, or other options could have been addressed, including reviewing historic tax credits or other incentives, grants that could have helped bring down that cost of rehabilitation. And then the last part was if the HLC were to deny the request, that the applicant should meet with the building official to figure out some next steps forward, which ultimately wasn't applicable because they denied the request. Which leads us to the appeal part. So that's what HLC reviewed. When that appellant submitted for appeal, any appeal requires an applicant to outline specifically which criteria they have issues with, and that leads to the grounds for appeal. So the applicant, and I'm sure he'll speak more to it, outlined kind of three key areas that were related to 6.080B, that's the eligibility for immediate approval for demolition. The criteria 6.080C, that's the cost related to putting money in to rehab the building. And then the last part was the comprehensive plan and how the overarching goals of the plan are applicable to the site. On the right side of this chart, and I'm going quickly, are some staff clarifications of how those codes are applied to this and how they were addressed in that original staff report. And as I mentioned, because the building official didn't deem this property an immediate threat to public health and safety, he did deem it, he red flagged it, so it's not able to be occupied right now, but that's very different from being an immediate threat. So there's a very clear difference between the buildings falling down versus the buildings just unsafe to occupy. Also, the structure was deteriorated due to neglect, not a catastrophic event. So it didn't apply to that code, and we can go back to it, that it wasn't by fire, wind, storm, something that caused it to go into disrepair. And again, that Article 9 allows staff to bump up, or community development director, to bump up any permit in lieu of staff reviewing to be reviewed by a land use body, so either APC or HLC in this case, which also opens it up for public input. So automatically, because staff deemed it not an immediate threat and not eligible for immediate demolition, it got bumped up to be reviewed by HLC. And moving on to the second level, staff noted that there were gaps in that financial analysis in the economic rehabilitation section that the applicant submitted, and that financials were not provided for a sale of the site if it were restored. It was specifically for renting out those apartments. And then the final piece about the comprehensive plan, which I outlined in some supplemental information, that the comprehensive plan is applicable to any land use decision. It's not specifically in development code because it's an overarching goal. So those are some clarifications as to what the issues raised by the appellant. I'm happy to answer questions. I know this is a complicated issue, but moving forward and what you've been asked to review, there's kind of two main options right now: to either deny the appeal, which upholds the HLC's decision to deny a demolition, or to approve the appeal, which allows the demolition and also allows for added options of conditions of approval. And I wanted to note that approving the appeal will require adopting new findings of facts because it would be reversing a decision already made by HLC. So we need to figure out some direction on where this now meets criteria and where it doesn't if you're adopting new findings of facts. I'm happy to answer any questions and also give time for the appellant to talk to.
Who was the building official, and when did the building official look at this property?
Building official's Ben Small, and I want to say he went out in December or January. It was before it made it to HLC. I think the applicant knows the actual date.
Okay. It's just interesting to me that engineer, Mr. Stricker, said that the property was a threat essentially to public safety, and the building official's assessment was not in concurrence with that. Is that something that the city would ever revisit upon seeing an engineer's analysis of the property?
Yeah, I mean, so this would be something that, you know, the building official reviewed the materials as well, and there is no change in decision that it's an imminent threat of meeting, you know, the need for immediate approval. It's up to the city council to make the determination as to what you would support. The issue at hand for immediate approval is whether or not staff could approve it over the counter. In the case here, the building official made the determination at the time that it was not an immediate threat, and so the item was moved forward to the Historic Landmarks Commission. And the appellant challenging this, as Ms. Ferber noted, there's a provision in the code that says at any point in time there's a staff decision that it's felt by the community development director that this requires more public input, more discussion, it can be automatically forwarded to the, in this case, the Landmarks Commission.
Okay.
I had a question about the $175,000 that would automatically trigger demolition approval. Where did that number come from?
I don't know where the 175 is, but off the top of my head, I'm guessing that's related to the 70% of the assessed value. That, again, would be grounds for immediate approval, but because we're sort of beyond that availability of immediate approval, it already went to HLC. That piece kind of isn't applicable anymore because we're reviewing even more of the financials. So the applicant's saying it's well beyond the 70%, but HLC found that no, in fact, the structure hasn't been damaged in excess of this value by these specific issues, fire, flood, wind, or other natural disasters, that it was due to the slope and the geologic issues at the site, but not a catastrophic event.
And Mayor, I would note that I think you're looking at the appellant's numbers, so I think it may be a more appropriate question to go to the Osbornes.
Okay, thank you.
Is the term catastrophic event anywhere in the code?
It's not. It's my interpretation of kind of what those key areas are, that fire, flood, and wind, that it has to be a big event for something to happen to a structure, not just due to neglect or ongoing deterioration of a site.
Could you review for me the reasons the building inspector gave for red flagging it as not occupiable after the tenants had been evicted?
Yes. I believe he had a letter in it.
Councilor, maybe if there's no other questions, Ms. Ferber can
she look for that during the next step.
Thanks.
Yeah, if Mayor Lemire, if you want to continue on with whatever's next, Ms. Ferber can look for that and get back to me.
Okay. Does anyone else have?
I don't have any comments at this moment.
No, that's not questions.
Okay. Do we want to go ahead and let
dig in and come back to you?
Yeah, you'll need to actually go through the process of opening the public hearing.
Okay. I will open the public hearing. Does anyone object to the jurisdiction of the City Council to hear this matter at this time? Does any member of the City Council feel he or she has a conflict of interest or any ex parte contacts to declare? Okay, persons speaking tonight should address their remarks to whether or not the application in question meets the necessary criteria, and if not, state why. The applicable criteria are listed in the staff report and may be obtained from the Community Development Director at the staff table. Failure to raise an issue in person or by letter to the City Council means an appeal of that same issue will not be permitted. If you wish to speak, please come forward to the lectern, give your name and address, and then give your testimony. And we're allowing Mr. Osborne 10 minutes this evening, but for the rest of you, 3 minutes, please, because it promises to be a long evening. So, Mr. Osborne.
So I've been waiting 2 months for 10 minutes. Anyway, thank you very much. I'm trusting that you work your way through the...
Name and address first.
Oh, Ted Osborne, 345 Alameda. Any debate about depleted buildings will be helpful. Our community has a lot to learn about how to handle them. Do you have the summary of data that I gave you about the costs and the earning value, so I don't need to give you... Okay. So I'll go right to the heart of it, because the issues are that if you have a building that's depleted, there are only three things in the code that really sort of keep you from having to pay exorbitant amounts of money for it. And right now we've seen that the cost to rehab it will equal a total investment on our part of $885,000, and at an 8% return on the apartments and working with the managers that we did, it would yield a value of about $450,000 at an 8% rate. So we've already done that issue of what can the apartments do, or what could we sell it for? We have a chance to spend $885,000 and sell it for under $500,000, which is a loss that is not reasonable for us to take. So we're very interested in looking at these three things that could possibly protect us. We didn't want to do this. We bought it with the idea that we would develop a piece of it on the site. The site went away when we found out from the geologist that it was not a wise idea to build there again. And we could maybe move over to the right of way, but that's another story which I will get to and have and enjoy talking to you about. So these three things are: is the cost 70% of the assessed value? And we contend that the building has been kicked off its foundation by the hill. It's taken a few years. It wasn't like some of the others, more dramatic on Alameda. But it's the same result. It's kicked off. The house is forlorn. The last couple of owners have operated it as if it's defeated. Let's just work it to death and get as much money out of it till it falls. We bought it to stop that cycle. We wanted to do something with it. We will still do something with it I'm going to take it apart myself. Collect the lumber, collect the organs. If something speaks to me about that pile that's left over, I want to build something. Either a little bit in the front of the site or over in the right of way. So we were very zealous about these three items. And so we've run into considerable preservation bias throughout this process. The planner and the preservation consultant were never interested in seeing the building. They never came over and went through it. A 928 email right shortly after we started this showed that the a decision to go to the HLC had already been made, and this is still 2 months before we put in our application. The staff position on the two items of the safety and the cost were not available until the HLC packet. which means for two or three months, we're saying, we think we have a poster child for B1, the 70% of assessed value. Assessed value is 250 in 2017. 70% of it is 175. Assessed value now is 189. The assessed value of the 70% is 132. And so it's startling to find that we didn't have any of that information until it went to the HLC. And then the HLC never touched any of that. They never reviewed any of that. One of the commissioners asked, what about that 70% rule? And the planner said, no, we're past that. We're not discussing that. So somehow, there's two things that are so important to somebody with a depleted building, and they don't come out till late, they don't get reviewed by anybody. Where did they go? We got two strikes on us without ever having a time at bat. I don't get it myself. And we'll review what the answers were there later. The third part is C1, which HLC is lined up to go through. They have four things to go through. We had C1, 2 through 4 were not applicable at all because we weren't moving it, we weren't doing this, we weren't doing that. So the issues, let me just talk about how we got through HLC. HLC was a strange hearing. I guess it's because they didn't really have that much to talk about, but they got through, the feasibility had been taken care of, the cost feasibility had been taken care of by Nancy saying, I agree that it's too costly to be feasible as an apartment, but that's the best use. And so why don't you look at other things that could be? So there was really not much discussion about that. But the HLC, so three members worked their way through the numbers that we presented and voted for us. Two others were all preservation without any consideration of numbers, and another guy flapped in the breeze, and that ended up going negative. So that's why we're here. And so I just want to go through maybe so I can get my breath. So let's do the film. Let's just slide. Can you do that, Jimmy?
Sorry, can I do what?
Or does that count? Will that count against my 3 minutes left?
3 minutes left. Yeah.
Will that count against it?
Yes.
Well, screw it then. Don't do that.
My hair, unless you want to.
Don't do that. I didn't realize that I'd be limited to 10 minutes. So let's go to the first.
I want to see the video. So let's see the video, and then we'll give you 3 minutes after that.
All right. Fair. It's a slideshow.
Slideshow.
Yeah. Forward. No, Nancy, you know where it is.
That's right after this one. One more. Yeah.
There it is. There it is. Just start it.
Jimmy, we want to start back at 3 o'clock, 3 minutes.
Okay, the first issue that's so important relative to the immediate approval, but one of the three things, is the 70% of assessed value. And we come up with our contention, and all the engineers are saying it's knocked off the hill, that is a natural event. It's cost a lot to do that. It's worth $460,000 to repair everything that comes from that displacement. And in the report to HLC, The staff's position was it was geologic damage, but not enough to warrant the 70% or not $132,000, which is highly suspect. And we said in our letter to you, they show no evidence of that. They've changed that now to it's not geologic, it's just neglect. Neglect is hard to displace something 9 to 12 inches. It's just not true. And so we think that we're right there and that we got violated on that particular issue. On the second one with the engineering, with the red tagging and the building official, the building inspector in training came out to inspect the building with his mentor, Jim Byerly, and made the point of saying that he was learning the job from Jim. He was learning on the job. We got, this is back in early November. He made the point of telling me right away, I'm new at this. This is sort of my first one out here to see. I'm bringing Jim to help me with it. Both were horrified with what they saw, declared the building to be in catastrophic structural failure, and said they would red tag the building and send me a letter that would support demolition. So they did. The 8 days later, they red tagged the building. The same day, when a brief tepid email came 8 days later saying it was a dangerous building per the 1997 uniform code, I called Ben and asked what happened. He said the planner wanted to save the building. So we have lots of engineers, contractors, preservationists who have been at the building saying it's scary, it's awful. On the basis of those things, we got pushed to HLC, who basically didn't do anything on these issues. They just told us to go sell it or do something, but keep it at all cost. I'd be delighted to take loads of questions on the ROW later on.
Thank you.
Mary, you can ask the questions to the applicant, council.
Do you have questions to ask at this time?
I have a question, Mr. Osborne, if that's okay.
Is the clock here?
No. Oh, okay. As far as this part about the economic feasibility to rehab this building, mm-hmm. Staff and the HLC are saying that you didn't look at things like tax incentives or grants. Can you talk about that?
Yes. I told them that I have where costs are, I'm looking for an extra $400,000 or $500,000. And so I have enough history with taxes and grants that if you're looking for that much money as a private citizen on a private thing, you wouldn't make a project pencil out based on the expectation of getting $500,000 worth of grants. The staff did say, well, we have a facade grant, we can get you $3,000 or $12,000, but it just didn't fill enough of the hole. And I said, quite frankly, when I did the building downtown, there were a couple of grants that were really nice, but I paid a lot more for them than I got in order to follow the directions they had. Grants are nice, and if we do a project, we will probably apply for it, but it's not something that you use to make the project pencil out.
Okay, and could you just briefly talk about your experience and how you are kind of an authority on this, on your experience and why you think that we should listen to you and the fact that you don't think you can get that many grants?
Well, because I mean, I've been doing this for 50 years and I've gotten various grants, and they're always small, they're well placed, They come out and they see what you're applying it to. They have other places that their money should go to. And I'm telling you that this is not, this would not be a preferred target for a public grant.
Okay. And how about the staff and HLC's argument about not looking at more potentially lucrative income from this property other than just as an apartment rental, like selling it or using it for something else?
Well, you know that when we bought it, there were other people looking at it, and nobody else had the stomach to buy it. And so somebody with the idea of having, I'm not wrong about how much it will cost to rehab it. The only corrections to my numbers have been people come by and say I'm far too low. So the reason for saying the 8% or 6.5% cap rate is that you can't spend $800,000 or $900,000 on something when it's only worth $400,000 or $500,000. And so you can't sell it. You shouldn't give it to somebody unless you hate them. They kept talking about angels. Well, there aren't dumb angels out there. Angels are smart. The whole concept of the Merwin was repaired by an angel. That company is not an angel. They're a smart company that took a year to figure out that the Merwin was a really, really good building with all basic bones and a foundation. And they figured out that they could make it work because they have access to grants that I don't. They're in the business of working with grants.
So did I hear you correctly in your assessment that it would cost $885,000 to rehab and you think that you could sell it for $450,000?
What the numbers said, which I asked you if you had, is that we paid $195,000 for it and our estimate is $690,000 to repair it. And the only corrections of the 690 is other experts have come by and say they think it's 900 to repair it instead of 690. So those two together add 885, and you figure out rents that are reasonable for that, and we work through several building managers. We take the net out of the rents, allowing some for gross and repairs, and it, with the cap rate, it yields a building the value of somewhere around $427,000 to $450,000.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions? Okay, not at this time, but we may call you back up.
Sure.
Okay. At this time, if there are others who want to speak in favor of the appeal at this juncture, come forward, state your name and address, please.
Good evening. My name is Dave Pollard. I live at 1676 Jerome. I speak in support of the demolition request. I have point out perhaps three areas of relevant experience that would perhaps help in this discussion. I have 28 years of experience restoring our home. I have 11 plus years on the Historic Landmarks Commission, including chair and as a member. And thirdly, we have just completed a significant earthquake retrofit of our home using the same individuals that Ted and Wendy have presented to you, and we have reasonable expectations that the costs that they're presenting to you are certainly legitimate and perhaps understated. I had some formal statements, but I think I'd just like to point out that the demolition request that we received in the 11 plus years or so that I was on the Historic Landmarks Commission were almost exclusively for buildings that were structurally sound. And it's interesting to me that this particular application has made it as far as it has, as unsound as the building actually is. I'd like to point out that the slideshow reflects the building perhaps in a favorable light.
Yeah.
When I went inside the building, I was just amazed at one, what horrible condition it was in. But I was almost also amazed that there were no systems in place by the city to have examined that building while renters were living in it. And once Ted and Wendy took a sue, I thought that there were better places to be than in the basement of that building. I have a whole packet, which I will blissfully not read to you, but you have my comments from the Historic Landmarks Commission meeting in your notes. But I'd just like to say that it's a legitimate request. It's always regrettable to take down an historic structure. I hate it. But this building was damaged far before Ted and Wendy ever moved into the neighborhood. And I'd like to argue that I believe that the slide in the back of that building that's pushing against the sill plate and forcing the cripple wall to basically push forward is every bit as much of a disaster as if it had happened overnight. It just took an awful lot longer to twist that building the same way that a hillside slide would have twisted it in a night. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Anyone else wish to speak in favor of the appeal?
Ed Overbay, 221 South Street, Astoria. I am an advocate for historic preservation. I'm also a builder. Since 1974, I've built, remodeled, and renovated homes in Astoria. That's all I've done. I do know a little something about buildings. I continue to participate in the Clatsop County College's Historic Preservation Department, which I helped conceive and get off the ground. Again, I am an advocate for historic preservation. That being said, it should also be said that we cannot, nor should we, try to save every building. Not every building that is old is necessarily worth the enormous effort necessary to rescue it. Not every building has good bones. Some buildings built back in the day were not particularly significant then. They were not imbued with any particular style or grace or architectural significance. Some buildings never rise to any particular historic significance. Some buildings are only significant because they've been squeezed for every nickel for decades and decades and decades, with people not putting in the requisite work to keep them up. There comes a time for every structure when it's realistic to put forth the effort to save it, and a point past which there are diminishing returns. Simple economics require that after too long, it's simply not worth saving. This is simple math, simple economics. This is formulaic. Just such a formula exists in our city code. When the cost to renovate exceeds 70% of a building's assessed value, an owner is within their rights to take it down. The deadline to save this particular building, in my professional opinion, was a good 30, 40 years ago. It's been neglected that long. The cost to renovate this building are wildly beyond anything sensible. There is no economic model, no magic business model that's going to save this building. The numbers are simply not there. If we'd seen, if there was such a model, they'd be sprouting up all over Astoria. It's not a realistic notion. There's nothing about this particular building's history that is compelling so as to justify the enormous expense beyond the building's inherent worth. There's nothing about this building's architecture compelling enough to justify such enormous expense. This is a very dangerous building. I've been in the building. That is also the opinion of a highly respected and qualified engineer, Andy Stricker, who inspected the building. Really? That's 3 minutes? All right, well, this building needs to come down. These people are trying to do the neighborhood a favor. You should let them do that.
Thank you. Anyone else?
Evening, Chris Hafer, 687 12th Street. Thank you, Ed. I think what he stated is absolutely correct. I've been a professional building contractor specializing in renovation historical homes since 96. I wanted to come here tonight to be impartial After seeing these slides and hearing what's going on, I have to say that I agree that the building should come down. It hurts me to say that. I'm an optimist towards restoration and preserving old structures, but in this case, it's sad to say that it's really not worth putting the expense in preserving a particular feature, and I can't quite figure out what that feature would be.
Thank you. Okay.
I'm Linda Oldenkamp, 1676 Jerome. Oldenkamp is spelled with a K. So I won't go into my testimony because I did it at the Landmarks Commission, and hopefully you got a chance to read that. But I just want to say that I am a major passionate preservationist, and I think all buildings should be saved. And so I don't quite agree with Ed, even, that there are some little old buildings that aren't beautiful. I think mostly, if they're old, they ought to be saved, and we ought to do everything that we can to save them. But I do, and this hurts me more than you can imagine to say this, but I do support this request to demolish the building. And it's a shame, because it looks sort of nice on the outside, but I have been in the building. And I agree with my husband, Dave, that the slides really didn't do really justice in terms of the state that the condition of the building is in. And so I think that given that the building was allowed to deteriorate the way that it was, it has reached the point. I hate to say it, but I have been in it, and it's reached the point where it is not salvageable. It's not able to be renovated at the point that it is. So, I guess. I've maybe had a few more things I wanted to say, but I can't remember. But but I do just think that this is a situation that does call for demolishing, and it really hurts me to say that, because I think we need to do everything we can to save our old buildings in Astoria, and it's what makes this city unique beyond any other city. And so I support the request.
Thank you. Anyone else speaking in favor of the appeal? Okay, anyone who wants just to speak against the appeal?
Good evening. I'm Rachel Jensen, Executive Director of the Lower Columbia Preservation Society, and our office is at 389 12th Street in Astoria. The Lower Columbia Preservation Society supports the findings of facts adopted by the Historic Landmark Commission on January 17, 2018, as well as the supplemental findings of facts presented in the memorandum dated March 12, 2018. The applicable code and criteria that have been in place for years, and certainly prior to the applicant's purchase of the property, they knew or should have known the criteria and process that would be involved with demolishing this building. They also were aware of, they had a chance to do due diligence in the process of purchasing the building. Staff worked with them and outlined the criteria that needed to be addressed in their application. The staff wrote a pretty clear report outlining how the criteria had not been met, highlighting the facts that the criteria had not been met for the demolition approval. HLC considered that application, staff for support and input from the public hearing, and voted to deny the request. Now that this has been appealed and supplemental information has now been submitted by the applicant, and now we're hearing additional information, it still remains inadequate in terms of addressing the criteria outlined in 6.080. Most importantly right now is the process is important to us. If the council overturns HLC's decision tonight, then it sets a precedent of deviating from the rules. Staff has outlined clearly in their reports how criteria was not met, how it could be met, and we do not believe that the applicant has fully addressed those issues now. So that's what I have tonight. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Anyone else who wishes to speak against the appeal?
Mayor Lemire and councilors, good evening. My name is Doug Thompson. I reside at 342 14th Street, apartment 602, in the National Register listed Astor Building downtown. I come before you tonight as a volunteer member of the Lower Columbia Preservation Society. I sit on the board of directors, and I'm part of the record at the HLC hearing. Please consider my remarks tonight as supplemental to my remarks previously. I want to give you several examples of historic structures that stand today because of incentives and because the rehabilitation of those structures did not pencil out until the federal 20% investment tax credit, until the state of Oregon's special assessment, assessed value freeze of 15 years. And as you'll see with the restoration of the Merwin next door, until the federal low-income housing tax credit. Those are very valuable tools, and you have to know how to use them. I have personal experience. We saved, and my partners and I saved, many years ago, a single-family dwelling that was among the very oldest in Uppertown, the Christian Erickson single family, 1877. It was in as bad a shape as the subject property you're dealing with tonight, albeit on a smaller scale. No foundation, off the foundation, wide open, rats, homeless, all of the above. In fact, it was so bad that the city of Astoria had let a contract for demolition. And when we finally had control of the property last minute, we had to buy out the bond of the demolition contractor. He had to walk away so we could buy it. That house, over the last 20 years, has provided safe, sanitary, decent housing, fully restored, and we took the tax credits and the special assessment. So I know how difficult these projects are. I've been through it myself. It's not fun, it's not easy, but it is worthwhile. I can give you examples of the Astor, which would not stand today, providing low-income housing for the last 32 years without the 25% federal investment tax credit. And the Merwin next door will have low-income housing tax credit and investment tax credit in order to make it work. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Anyone else?
Hi, I'm Sarah Barty. I live at 1661 Irving Avenue in Astoria. I don't wish to argue that this building doesn't need a great deal of work. It clearly does. I more want to pose a question of intent. I myself am restoring an old home in Astoria, and I think it could be seen to be possible or feasible for maybe an uneducated first-time home buyer to purchase a building without realizing the spectrum and the scope of work that would go into fixing it. But I find it surprising that someone who not only lives down the street or adjacent to this building, but someone who is an architect who has worked in the construction industry for 50 years, as was just stated, could make such a grave error. In short, I believe that this building was purchased with the intent to be demolished. That's all I have to say. Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else?
Mike Sensenbach, 110 Kensington. Basically, the issue at hand here today is just this specific application to demolish a primary contributing structure in the Uniontown Alameda National Register Historic District. Professionally, I have worked in property claims for approximately the last 15 years for one of the largest property casualty insurance companies in the country. Currently, my role is that of an internal auditor reviewing property insurance files for adherence to regulatory guidelines, which include, at times, development and building codes. As I see it, this case is simple, and it comes down to this. Does this application meet all of the applicable criteria for demolition of a historic property? I hope you've all had the opportunity to review the staff reports and the minutes from the HLC meeting and all of the applicable criteria which have not been met. I'm here tonight to support the city staff and their findings of fact. I am hopeful that you all will do the same. The onus is on the applicant to prove that the criteria has been met. And while they may have demonstrated that a portion of the criteria may have been met, they need to prove that all of the criteria have been met. It's not a situation where enough of the criteria has to be met. It all has to be met. And it all had to be met at the HLC review. It seems strange to me that in an appeal, we're allowing new information to be considered or introduced along with additional testimony that is not speaking directly to the appeal and the process, the slides, for example, that they were not available for HLC's consideration, but here we're reviewing them here today. And as Nancy pointed out earlier, should you decide not to support the city staff and HLC, you'll be tasked with amending the findings of fact as outlined in the staff reports. I think it'll be challenging for any alternative facts to be supported as well as the facts have been supported in the staff reports. In regards to the question about the engineer, that he had posed originally, if I could just have like another 20 seconds. That same engineer, if you actually go down and review all of the property files for all of Ted's properties, that same engineering firm participated in convincing, in putting forth a convincing argument that that land was actually stable enough for him to build his house on the adjacent property just a few years ago. And now that same engineering firm is saying that land is not stable and that's what's pushing over the property. So that's all I have for you guys. Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else?
Jan Greger, 1546 Franklin. My main problem with this is I just object to the whole idea of
economic feasibility being the premise, I would argue that it never makes economic sense in this town for anybody to come in and spend the money they do, but they do. And you see it, you can look out the window right at the old bank building or all these buildings where people spent tons to bring them back. It's wonderful. The town's come back because of history, but you can't say it was economically feasible. You would level the whole town if economic feasibility was the criteria. But I just think it should be put on the market and see if somebody from Portland or whatever wants to come. We're stewards of these places, and I think that a lot of these houses outlive the humans, and somebody comes along that does want to put the money into it, and I think he should at least try to sell it and see if somebody wants to do it or do it that way. At least draw this out a little longer and see if somebody is interested in restoring it. Thank you.
Anyone else speaking against? Okay, anyone impartial to this appeal? You have an opportunity to rebut at this point, Mr. Osborne.
I would like to. Basically, in terms of the building for sale, we bought it just a few months ago, and it was available for everybody to buy. And the only ones that came by were other people that were going to operate it as a slum and just grind it out and just wait till it fell over. In terms of the adjacent property, we went through a lot with Rosemary. What was her name? Rosemary Johnson. We had to do two geologic studies to build our house. We were new to the neighborhood. We got Tom Horning in here. Behind our house is a much gentler slope. We sat our new house within a retaining wall of the old house that had been torched in '83, that was still without cracks. We sat our new house with deep piles in that opening, separated from the hill. And I designed it so that the whole thing would come down, and if there was a slide, it would slide through, take out the first floor, and leave my wife and me up at the top two floors. So in doing that, he was able to study the hill beside there, and he see it's steeper, and it's all going out diagonally, sort of northwest toward Kingston. But the problem is that the purple house is built right into the hill with a series of retaining walls that are just shoving. So my house was risky, but I took care of it and I figured it out. The same engineer has seen that over there, helped us with this. That's what engineers do. As for did we buy it with the intent to tear it down, why would I want to go through this? I mean, we bought it. I've been drawings for a year of the section I wanted to save in the house. I was going to take the saddlebags off the side, drop it down a floor, and move it over as far as I could on that property. I've got drawings all over the place with planned development. What happened right off the bat was this engineer came along and said, "Don't be that silly. It's kicked off the hill, it'll kick the next house off the hill. It'll keep moving it. So do not build there." And that's when we went over and asked for the ROW, which would certainly take another 3 minutes. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. At this time, we'll close the public hearing. Does someone have any further questions of the applicant? Okay. Close the public hearing. Council questions and clarification from staff, if you have.
So I'd like to, Mayor, if I could, go back to Councilor Jones' question about the, you know, with what I understood in communicating with the building official and also with Jim Byerly is that while this property was not the point of being an imminent danger to collapse. They post red tagged it to say it's not occupiable. And you can see from the pictures in the building, you know, probably why it was not occupiable for residential purpose at this point in time. I would note that the city red tagged the Merwin Hotel in the 1980s as well, meaning that it was a case where no one should reside in it. There's no first floor, you know, hole in that area, and it's been sloughing off towards the library. So in this case, you know, it was not to a point that would be considered habitable for residential uses without upgrades. But in their opinion, it was not to the point of imminent collapse or danger.
Anyone else? Okay. Comments from the council?
Well, I lean toward approving the appeal request. I think the applicant and those who testified have made a good case that the structure is not economically feasible to rehab.
Okay. Anyone else?
What I find is that I mean, I have questions, but I don't know but I've heard all the answers, I think. And I'm just trying to sort out what that means. I can understand that this is a building that would take great resources to restore to any usable, to be a usable space, be a rental or a home or whatever kind of economic activity, just to put it back in, just in my experience and looking at the evidence. My question is, when you look at a historic building and you say, is it that we restored at any cost? Yes, I understand it's a high mark when you buy a historic home. I've been in many of the historic homes that people have been working on. I've worked on some of them myself, and I understand that. And I've always been of the opinion, if you buy that house, you need to do your due diligence. You have to know that if you're going to replace a window, it's not going to be a vinyl window. You're going to have to spend a little extra money and put in something that is going to reflect the historic character of the building. I get that. And but I also wonder, isn't there a line somewhere that a building is just not economically feasible for the average homeowner or even above average homeowner to repair? I look at what the Merwin's doing, and we've talked to the people who are coming in to restore that. These are professionals. These are people that do this for a living. They know where the money is. They know how to find it. They have funding so that they can do their due diligence and see if it can pencil out in a way. And for them to do that, is they're looking at making a very long-term commitment. 20 years, they're not buying the building and turning it over, they're buying the building and they're going to manage it for the foreseeable future. That's a different scenario than an individual buying a house next door. I'm a little troubled that Mr. Osborne looked at that building and thought he could do something with it. I'm a little surprised at that. I would imagine that you saw all the pitfalls and all the costs that were potentially in front of you and how this might turn out. But that's, at this point, sort of neither here nor there. Intent is not what we're trying to determine here. But based on what I've seen from the staff, too, you know, we're working within guidelines that have been laid out, and I think the staff has done their best to make their argument. And by the way, I'm a little concerned when somebody makes an accusation towards one of our staff, insinuating that our planners had intention. And I'm very curious about that. Because I don't believe that our staff, that's not our staff's job. And I'd be surprised if they're actually thinking that way. They're being impartial and working according to the rules of the city. But I don't see a lot of room to maneuver here unless we take that 70% of cost to repair. And the only thing I can come up with there is that when my interpretation of fire, flood, wind, other natural disasters, or by vandalism, I can see interpreting it for natural disaster, that a slide is a natural disaster. I don't care how slow it is or how fast. Look at Bond Street, it happened all of a sudden. You know, it's still a slide and Earth is moving. And I realize we have that sort of all over the place in that story and people deal with it all the time. But unless it's dealt with soon or early, it just gets worse. And I can see considering this a natural disaster from that standpoint. And also, this may be stretching a little bit, but I do wonder if, we humans aren't sometimes a natural disaster. When you have a variety of ownership over time, neglect a building and get away with it and let it deteriorate to a point to where it's not feasible, that's not the current owner's necessarily their issue. We had the cannery, we had the oil spill out here. We had an oil tank that finally ruptured, and we had an oil spill out here. And there was no memory of it being there. I mean, they've been looking for, they had to go back away. Through changes of ownership over time, neglect happened, things were forgotten, disaster ensued. So it just does happen, and we are responsible to a certain degree. So if I were to side for, because I think it's just onerous to expect anybody to spend the money to try and save this. And I think that if people want to save it, do a GoFundMe site. Raise the money, put up a fund. I mean, the city doesn't have the resources to do this, to take care of all these buildings. It's been left up to the individuals. And I just think that there's got to be a line somewhere. Again, I love also historic preservation. I see it and I support it. And I just think people need to do their due diligence. But sometimes, maybe it's just not worth saving.
I'm going to speak specifically to the criteria, and this will be from page 4 of the staff report. It's also 4 or page 18. It starts with building history and current use condition, and then goes on to page 19, applicable review criteria. So we have first section, it's under 4A. This is on page, I don't know how to say what page it is, page 19, page, what page is it in the packet? 72. Okay, so A is fine, 4A. And then there's 4B, which states that the structure has been damaged in excess of 70%. Well, I don't think there's any of its assessed value. There doesn't seem to be any disagreement about that, really. The building official finds the structure to be immediate and real threat. All other requests will be reviewed by the Historic Landmarks Commission. So we've agreed that the building inspector did not find that, and so it went to HLC. I'm going to kind of move past the 70% a little bit, except that it says that much of the damage has been due to neglect by previous owners, the findings say this, and not all through geologic damage, fire, flood, wind, natural disaster, or vandalism. And I think this is hard to judge, because which came first? Vandalism or neglect? Wind damage or neglect? Water damage or neglect? Geologic damage or neglect? This is really an interpretive thing that is made. The applicant's description of the interior that we received previously and the slides tonight implied that it was both geologic damage and neglect, both everything and neglect. Flood and wind damage, I sort of fall into what Tom had said. I mean, these things can occur over relatively short periods of time, not just in one catastrophic event, which is not a term that is used in the code. I really appreciate having the public review, and I should have started out by saying that I think the Historic Landmarks Commission is and the work that they do is so important. They are the gatekeepers to one of the legs of, I think, the three-legged stool that makes Astoria, and it's our geography, it's our culture in general, and it's our historic building stock. And that's where HLC comes in, and the work they do is extraordinarily important. But I think this section of the code really needs to be reviewed for two reasons. First is 70% of assessed value, a realistic red line for rehabilitation of a distressed historic structure, most of whom go on the market for very low amounts of money and have been neglected for years and have low assessed values. And second, to better define the differences between wind, fire, flood, and geologic damage, natural disasters, and catastrophic events. Then we go to C, and the C1 is that the structure cannot, this is what the code says, the structure cannot be economically rehabilitated on the site to provide a reasonable income or residential environment compared to structures in the general area. So there's been a lot of talk about moving the building and all of that, which is not on the site. The finding states that a residential property would be the best use, and again, doesn't disagree with the cost, well exceed reasonable time renovation cost. I'm interested in the suggested other uses, daycare centers, residential facilities, neither of which I think exist in the neighborhood, would probably stress the already tight parking situation, would require purchase of additional property or a use to use the right-of-way, which has already been denied once, or maybe a bed and breakfast. Maybe none of this would be approved. Another suggestion is to turn it into short-term rentals, a use which this council is seeking to very tightly regulate. Some of us would like to outright ban them, and I don't know of any of us who have really an interest in actively promoting that sort of use. So I don't accept this finding. Number two, C2 on the next page, is that there's a demonstrated public need for a new use if any is proposed. Well, none has been proposed. The finding states that since no new use is proposed, no further analysis can be provided. In other words, not applicable. Three is the same thing. The proposed development is any. Again, there isn't one. But the finding goes on with it in any case and says that the creation of a vacant lot as a result of a demolition may detract from the historic context of this high-density area. And I have driven by this house. I've certainly never been in it, as very few people apparently have. And one of the interesting aspects of this neighborhood is the number of vacant lots that are there, that provide really a kind of a rest for these big, giant, old historic houses. In fact, the very first thing you see when you come off, I think it's Columbia, and turn onto Alameda, is looks to be at least three lots wide. This beautiful manicured lawn with a white picket fence. Again, many others. There are various others. There's the hillside blackberry field east of Alameda Park, and then a really nicely maintained grassy area on the other side of the park, which may be part of the park, I'm not quite sure. And anyway, others. So I just can't think, and I couldn't find via research, any neighborhood that's negatively impacted by a scattering of well-maintained vacant lots. Now, if it's a hole in the ground with cyclone fence around it, well, we know what that looks like. But I'm fairly certain that that is not what the Osbornes had in mind. Number four, again, if the building is proposed to be moved, it's not proposed to be moved, so the finding is that this is not applicable.
May I take a couple more minutes?
Sure, go ahead.
Thank you.
And so then we go to the comprehensive plan sections. And the first one is that the city will promote and encourage, by voluntary means, whenever possible, the preservation, restoration, et cetera. And for this, I am very grateful. But I'm also very disappointed that we don't have the capacity to have strong or much enforcement of our derelict building ordinance. If it could be more diligently enforced, and all we need is a giant bag of money, large denominations, it would prevent buildings like this from getting to the point where they can't be saved. So, and then it goes on to compare this house, as we've heard from others, this residential house built of wood in 1908, for laborers and who lived in the area, fishermen and stuff, who built this town, with 1920s brick and concrete commercial buildings that are in the downtown core. And I see that as apples and oranges. The finding states that adaptive reuse would add to the city's historical heritage of providing unique workforce housing options. But we clearly, there's no disagreement that the costs associated with renovating this house and bringing it up to standards would not create workforce housing. It would create some of the most expensive rental housing in Astoria. So that doesn't help. And then C2 says every possible effort will be made to relocate historical structures as an alternative. This is not a small residential home. This is a 4,680 square foot, 3.5 story building, not including the basement. The council recently balked at moving the customs house, a little tiny thing, because of the expense involved. The finding concedes the geologic issues at the current site. It's unknown whether the city would approve the move to another portion of the property, either the full building or a portion of it, if the right-of-way would be granted. So I'm not sure why anyone would want to go to this cost and do all of this for, yes, a historic but a non-significant building. And moving the building off-site is just really out of the question and is certainly not required because the development code does talk about on the site. Gifting or selling to a nonprofit, that's just kind of, the comprehensive plan, one part that wasn't mentioned was CP020.2. The city encourages historic preservation generally and the restoration or reuse of existing buildings. However, these structures must be improved in a timely manner. So how long enough to wait for some angel to drop by? You know, what does the continued blight do to the neighborhood? Three and four talk about economic development, which really has nothing to do about this. 4D, I think, talks about documenting the demolition, which I think is a good idea, and I would ask that that be done should the demolition permit be granted. And the most likely outcome of denying this appeal is going to be a boarded up vacant building that sits for years and ironically probably the city will start assessing penalties to the current owner for not fixing it up. The Osbornes have shown that they've conducted well more than their due diligence to save this building. They pleaded with the city for years to address its neglect and with the owner and its detriment to the neighborhood. They've consulted with engineers, geologists, historic preservationists. They purchased the property at a high bid with the explicit intention of preventing the property from remaining in neglect and a danger to the community. No one else was interested. We want our historic buildings of all sorts, whether they're demolished or not, to be our properties to be owned by community members, not by investors who are going to just take whatever they can, wring whatever they can, and the neighborhood be damned. Mr. Osborne himself is an architect in historic preservation. He lobbied strongly for the preservation of the Merwin and to keep the library as the library, and I think we will all benefit from that. And we have testimony in favor of the demolition by community members who have spent their entire adult and probably teenage lives preserving old homes at Overbay, Linda Oldenkamp, Dave Pollard. Everyone who has actually been inside the house wants to run for cover. I'm satisfied that renovation is achievable at all, if at all, only at a cost higher than anyone would possibly afford, thus eliminating any possibility of it providing workforce housing. I think demolition, sadly, is the only option for this building, and that its absence will be a benefit to the neighborhood and relieve a burden on the planning and public safety departments. And thank you for giving me all that time. Okay. Councillor Jones.
Well, I do find this a difficult case, and I can certainly understand why the HLC had a 3-3 split decision rather than a unanimous decision on either side. I am sympathetic to the argument that Mr. Osborne, as he stated in his written comments, made the emotional decision to pay too much for this house, and had certainly had the opportunity to do a walkthrough, and I'm sure he had a building inspector look at the building before he went to closing, as I've certainly always done with every house I've bought. I think he was pretty well aware of the terrible condition of the building, so I have a hard time thinking that you had any serious intent to rehabilitate it and put six housing units back in service after you ejected your tenants. Having said that, in the absence of any rebuttal engineering report from the city that contradicts the engineering report you've provided, I would tend to agree that the economic feasibility of trying to restore this house and returning it to housing stock it's not feasible. And so I would reluctantly agree with approving the appeal request.
Okay. I think you covered everything I was going to say, but a catastrophic event, I agree with Dave Pollard that a catastrophic event doesn't have to happen overnight. Certainly a continuous slide down the hill is a catastrophic event. And if the structural engineer and the geologist, and as you mentioned, some of our best preservationists are in the city are saying that this is not salvageable, then I don't think it is salvageable. I think there's nothing truer than a picture is worth a thousand words, and those pictures certainly showed this building needs to come down. So,
Mayor, I would note that the whole new set of, based upon the directionals of the council, a whole new set of findings will need to be prepared. Councilor Price went through a
litany.
That was actually my word, but I didn't want to use it necessarily.
Okay. But, I have it written down and can provide it.
And I guess if there was some concurrence from the council to use that as a basis, that can assist the planning staff in capturing that. And if there's other comments, that we've heard tonight, I'm really looking at, the specific criteria that's applicable is the structure cannot be economically rehabilitated on the site to provide reasonable income or residential environment compared to structures in the general area as being the primary applicable criteria that the council is finding. If that's the case, you would want to look at the option of tentatively approving the appeal request and then bringing the findings back to your next regular meeting of April 2nd.
So I move that the Astoria City Council tentatively approve the appeal by Ted Osborne and approve the original demolition request and direct staff to provide revised findings of fact at our next regular meeting scheduled for April 2nd at 7 p.m. in the City Hall Council Chambers.
Second.
Okay, now.
It doesn't need roll call.
Okay, all those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
And Mayor, you don't need to read that language tonight. That would come after you would, the Land Use Board of Appeals language would come after a final council decision has been made.
Okay. Okay, that.
Well, there's still the end of the meeting in terms of any city citizen testimony.
Okay. And I have closed the public hearing already. Okay. Then that concludes our regular agenda. But if there is anything else that you would like to address the council about, come up and do that at this time.
Good evening, Mayor, Councilors. Sean Fitzpatrick, 1046 Grand Avenue. I would hope that since the derelict building ordinance has been brought up tonight, I would hope that the city put some resources toward that. When we put that into effect several years ago, I was very supportive of it, and we had a number of buildings that we were concerned about. One of them, Mr. Hapker purchased. It was a house that had been abandoned for approximately 40 years, and he's put it back online, and it is habitable, which is great. It's been a serious improvement to our neighborhood. It's nice not seeing raccoons coming in and out, but actual people with bicycles and families and so on. About the same distance in the opposite direction is 936 Grand Avenue. I believe that's the correct address. And this is one that I have, it was one that I was concerned about 6 or 7 years ago when we put the derelict building ordinance into place. The property changed hands about 2 or 3 years ago. They started some work, and then it got stalled out about a year and a half ago. And I'm just looking at some pictures that I took on December 20th of 2016, and the house has a bunch of trash in front and missing windows. And we had an extremely rainy winter. I can't imagine how much damage was done to that house during that time. I took another picture in March. Trash is still out in front. Windows are still missing. I'm sorry, that was March of 2017. And the last time I walked by the building, it still has trash out in front. Windows missing. Water is doing all sorts of damage to the interior. I can only imagine. If we had the resources to actually do something about the complaints that come in on these properties, it would be greatly appreciated by the neighbors. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Anyone else? Thank you all for attending this meeting. It was grueling, but we appreciate all of you being here and expressing your opinions. This meeting is adjourned.